It's vital that we find within ourselves a real and true stillness. It's the root that holds realization intact. Without the stillness, one's like a tree without a root. You may have great insight. You may even have great awakenings. But without the root, without a deep inner stillness, it'll all be top heavy. It'll all fall over. And it'll leave you wanting more. So to have some real rootedness in stillness and in silence is really quite vital. It's not vital for a flash of awakening. It's not necessary for that. But I've never met anyone that had reality take a deep, deep, deep root within them that wasn't themselves rooted in a very deep inner stillness. It's always that way. And yet one doesn't become still by trying to make it so. You become still by opening your mind as vast as you can, by opening your heart so it's vast enough to include everything that may happen. So that your mind is vast like space, so that it also is big enough to include all the thoughts that go through it. Because when it's very vast, then you don't get knocked off balance by them. You don't lose your way. Because after all, we really are a full, solid emptiness. We are each of us mountains of nothingness, pure spirit walking this strange planet. In our own way, each person feels the inner calling. Each feels it different. But each being feels the call of existence. We all feel that pull of remembrance. That which pulls on us to remember our true nature. And so to become this vast, we have to rid ourselves in some way of all that the mind creates. Not only now, not only in you, but throughout all of time. All that the mind has created, as useful as it is, as an amazing technology as nature has devised, it is not the answer to human suffering. It is not the answer to our personal, one's personal sorrow, grief, violence, nor our collective violence. A collective stupidity. So it is no small thing, really, to leap beyond everything the mind has created. Not only in your mind, but in all other minds. It is no small thing to break free of that great gravitational force of the dream state. Because there is a great gravity to it, is there not? It is quite something for anyone to enter into that state of aloneness. Because when you go beyond your own mind, and you go beyond the collective mind, all of them, you leave the known behind. You leave all your familiar points of reference, and you are suddenly alone. And there is nothing there to be with you. There is no mate. There is no teacher. There is no teaching. The greatest sutras are not there. The greatest utterances are not there. All those great teachings that have come to us are from people just like you, who themselves have let go enough, have gone beyond, really, truly beyond, this whole collection of collective mind, and brought back something with true vitality. Because this is really the place of true creativity and true vitality. It's the difference between something that's alive and something that's dead. It's the difference between living words and dead words. A living word is a sutra. A dead word is a philosophy, an ideology. And so as grateful as you may be that someone, somewhere, at some time, have really gone beyond everything our minds create, have really touched upon the deepest essence of existence, though we may be very grateful for that, we may admire it. We may make statues of such beings and worship them, all the rest. But actually, really, you and I, we are called to the same thing. No less. And no less will do. It is a risk. But it is a risk you long ago assumed. Don't think that anyone was going to tell you it was such a risk before you took it. And this thing we call truth, reality, we talk about it as if it's something you realize in a moment, and then you hold on and you've got it with you. You've attained the great pearl. But what a misunderstanding that is. If that's your understanding, you may attain it, but you'll lose it in short order. It's a reality is existence. It's a living thing. It's a living thing. It's like your very life, your very blood. It's a living thing. Stop it. formalize it into a dogma, even in your own mind, and it becomes dead. Define it in your own mind, believe what your mind tells you, and it's dead. So to peer out into the unknown is not a one-time deal. It's not so you can go there, get something wonderful, get your realization, and come back. It's something that is constantly being the necessity of renewing it day to day. Reality is something that needs to renew itself day to day to day to day to day. It's a renewal. It's not as soon as it's not being renewed, it's static, it's dead. It's not very long before what seemed so precious and wonderful dried up. My teacher told me a wonderful thing. When the awakening happened, she said, "Be careful with it. Don't let it become a dream that once happened long ago." That was a very wise thing. She didn't tell me how. She just said, "Be very careful. Don't let it become a thing that once happened a long, long time ago." And so I learned that it was not something I could possess or own. It's not something that made me special. Quite different, quite the opposite. It's something that brings us down into our own shoes. My own teacher's definition of enlightenment was very simple: learning to walk on your own 2 feet. The Buddha walked on his own 2 feet. He didn't walk in somebody else's feet. Jesus walked on his own 2 feet, not in somebody else's feet. And so it goes. That's what I mean by entering your aloneness. We don't need another Buddha. We don't need another Jesus Christ. The Buddha's alive and well everywhere you look. We don't need another manifestation that looks just like that. Life doesn't have much patience for exact copies. Look around you. 7 or so billion of us, how many of us look exactly the same? Life is a bit, if it's anything, it's creative. So when you are dealing with whatever you deal with, joy, love, sorrow, happiness, despair, jealousy, compassion, hate, anger, you're not just experiencing your happiness, your anger, your confusion. You're experiencing anger, confusion, everybody's. The particulars may be unique to you, but the confusion is universal. And I think this is forgotten in spirituality a lot of times. It's expected that we have a certain amount of self-obsession. But it's also necessary for us to see a bigger perspective also than just a self-obsession. Like the Buddha, what is suffering? What is the cause of suffering? Is there a relief, a release from suffering, sorrow, anguish, that seems to be such an integral part of human existence? He was encountering these experiences from a universal place. Not why do I suffer simply, but why do we suffer? Why am I confused? But why, what is confusion? Because all these states that we experience are actually completely universal. That's the beauty of it. And it's hard for us to get clear on any of this unless we have some inner stability. Otherwise, the next thought that comes, the next idea, the next time you're triggered, you get pushed quite off balance. So it's really vital that you really realize that aspect of oneself, that aspect of existence that is really rooted in a very deep and eternally silent place. It's already there. It's already rooted in a very, very deep stillness. What's important is to recognize it, give it some time, some energy, some attention, give it your heart. Because if you have no real inner stillness, life buffets you around all over the place. If you have not realized your own infinite spaciousness, the spaciousness of the awareness that you're listening to these words with, that awareness is infinitely spacious. That awareness can look up into the night sky and engulf multitudes of universes in a single glance. They are all contained in one glance of awareness. It's infinite. And there's a sacredness to it because it's not something that has been created by imagination. It's a timeless reality. For all the time spiritual seekers waste on trying to be more aware, and believe me, I wasted a lot of time with the rest. And what's missed in all that is all that trying to be aware is happening within the infinity of awareness. We don't need to try to struggle to be more aware. Life isn't waiting and asking you to strive really hard to be more aware. If anything, life is just waiting for you to recognize, to give recognition to what's already there. You can't enhance what's already there. Awareness is there. You can't enhance it. You can't make it better. It's infinitely vast. You can't make it vast, but you can give it recognition. Notice, yes, there. Yes, it is here. You can take a moment to really give your attention, to really give your heart and your mind to it. The more you do, the more you'll feel yourself this very strange, wonderful paradox of being an infinite vastness and an infinite closeness. They actually don't come separate from each other. Have you experienced that? Infinite vastness as if everything is contained within you, far, all of it's out front, in front. And at the same time, because of that vastness, everything is there's absolute intimacy with what is. And closer than close. So close, there's no close. Where you can feel the sky as your own. These are really heads and tails. This is why we always open this kind of time together with some silence. Because there are a lot of talk. There is a lot of talk in a day like this. But I can guarantee you, my teacher didn't teach me anything that I'm talk about. She had more sense than that. She gave me something better than talk. When I came to her and I said, I really must know what's real. I must know. Not, I didn't even want to know. I had to know. Do you know the difference? For me, the desire for reality, for enlightenment, whatever you want to call it, was like a disease. It was like getting the flu. One day I'm quite happy. Quite happy. I didn't seek this to be happy. I was pretty happy. I was one of those rare people, relatively happy, for no fault of, you know, for no credit of my own. Pretty happy. I get bitten by the enlightenment bug. Do you know? Like a disease seeps into your system. Now you need this thing that you didn't need before, that you didn't care about before, but now you have to find out. You know? The only cure for this dreaded disease of spiritual seeking is to find the reality, to wake up not to it as much as it. It's the only cure. I just wanted relief from the damn disease of seeking. Mm-hmm. I didn't even care if I ended up being happy. Have you ever got that reckless? Do you know what it is to be reckless like that? Where you go, I don't care. I had that moment. I don't care. I even said it to myself. I said, I don't care. I don't care if reality is the worst, most awful, demonic thing in the world. If it's true, I've got to know. Why do I have to know? I don't know. I have to know. If it ends up being the best thing in the world, fine. That's good. I'll know that too. If it's neither one, fine. I don't care. That's what I always call it, an irrational impulse. It doesn't really make sense. It doesn't make sense because when you come from a personal point of view, everything is about ourselves. But that beautiful yearning for the divine, it doesn't come from our idea of ourselves. It comes from existence itself. It comes from the divine itself. And so we don't really need to seek the fulfillment of that yearning, because that makes us go in the wrong direction. Because doesn't a yearning start at the most intimate place inside of you? So intimate and so close, you can't even say exactly where it is, but it starts deep inside of you, and it kind of goes like this. It reaches out. Almost like, I yearn for, and the energy starts deep inside of you, and it reaches out. What I yearn for, I want, I yearn for God, I yearn for. Sometimes maybe it's just a relief. If you're having a really bad day, I yearn for happiness. And so what do? We follow that direction, don't we? You follow that energy. So you start deep, deep, deep inside. And the energy seems to go out, so you go out. But really, it's about reversing that, taking the backward step, realizing that that yearning is actually a call. When you are called, you don't go in the direction that the voice is heading towards, because the voice is heading away from its origin. If I call your name, the sound is going from my mouth away from me, isn't it? Imagine if someone says, well, the call is going away from you, so I turn around and I'm going to find you by following the direction that the call's going in. But that's not what we do, do you? Somebody calls your name and intuitively you seek the origin of the voice, where it came from. It's a natural thing for all of us. Someone calls your name, you look, where did that come from? Not where is that sound going, but where did it come from? And isn't it ironic that in spirituality we do just the opposite? We get so hung up on where is it going, rather than where did it come from? Where did that yearning come from? Where did that wanting come from? Whether it's for enlightenment or peace or happiness. Where did it come from? That's what's important. That's the backward step. That's tracing it back to where it came from. Because when you finally trace it all the way back, all the way, and all the way is all the way. As one great Zen master said, one thought sets apart heaven and hell. So all the way means all the way. When we come back all the way, what we realize is the call came from absolute fullness. It never did come from a lack. It came from absolute happiness, absolute love, absolute clarity, absolute enlightenment. That's where it came from. But we only realize that when we take the backward step back from where it came from. It's like you fall into stillness. Because you know you wake up in the same way that you go to sleep. Waking up isn't really a great word. It's really not. You really fall awake. Like you fall asleep. How do you fall asleep? Do you know? All the insomniacs know how to fall asleep. They got all the strategies, right? They know how they're going to make it happen. They're up all night applying the strategies. People that sleep well, they have no idea how they fall asleep. They really have not the slightest notion. They lay their head back on the pillow, and before you know it, they're gone. How did you do that? I don't know. I just put my head on the pillow and let go. You fall asleep. Actually, spiritual awakening is a lot like that. You fall awake. In the morning, if the alarm clock doesn't go off, that is. How is it that you wake up? Do you know how you wake up? Or you just kind of fall awake in the same way you fell asleep? All of a sudden, you kind of blurrily open your eyes. Oh, you're still here. So please don't put yourself in any way outside or lesser than anyone. Like I say, the Buddha was just like you. And he said as much. Jesus Christ said all these things and more. You shall realize. All these things and more. That's a pretty clear message, I would say. You see, because it's not about you and I, not about our thought about ourselves, whether our thought about ourselves is lofty or humble. It's about that inner yearning itself. It's singular. The yearning the Buddha felt is the yearning you feel. The yearning Rumi felt is the yearning you feel. That's why you resonate when you hear about it, because it's the same thing. You're no more nor less than anyone that's ever existed on the planet. That may be hard for you to take in for some people. You are no more nor no less than anyone. Great Zen Master Wang Po said, it is no greater for being manifest as the Buddhas and no less for being manifest as ordinary human beings. Of course, the reason is ordinary human beings are Buddhas, and Buddha is ordinary human beings. But a fat lot of good it does you unless you know that. But even if you don't, it's still true. And he was saying that hundreds of years ago. But still, even with all that, even with everything that's spoken, with all the great teachings there are, if you take them in at all, they must be taken in and taken into a very quiet place inside of you. A very quiet, very tender place inside of you. That's where they're meant to be taken. Not added to the collection of noise in your mind. Because a real teaching is meant to be like a vacuum cleaner. It's a, what do they call them? It's a virus. You know, like a computer virus? You think it's something that's going to be added. Oh, that's a nice teaching. I'll put that in my mind and my system. Yeah, but if it's a good teaching, that teaching will start to undermine everything in there. So you'll gnaw away at it. And worse than that, if it's a really good teaching, it won't replace it with anything else. You see, a bad teaching will gnaw away at your conditioning, but then as soon as it empties you a little bit, it'll shove itself in there, you see. That's called like cultish behavior nonsense. You're deconditioned and then reconditioned with something else. But really, the deepest spiritual teachings are not meant to do that. They're just meant to decondition us and not replace it with anything else so that we fall into our own infinity. As the Buddha himself said, I gained absolutely nothing from unexcelled enlightenment. Isn't that lovely? I gained absolutely nothing from unexcelled enlightenment. Attributed to the Buddha. Isn't that the rub? I attained nothing. When you realize that, you realize that is like the most blessed thing that anyone could ever realize. The nothing, that nothing that's unattainable, ungraspable, unownable, that then the deepest truth, there is no truth to lay hold of. That's like music to the universe. There has long been a tradition in Zen for the masters to, when they were getting near death, to write their death poems. And there are many death poems written by the great masters of Zen. My favorite, however, is a certain master. And his students came up and said, "Well, you are dying, and it's time to write your death poem." And he looked at them, and he just said, "What nonsense. The only hope I have is that when I'm gone and dead, I'm entirely, but only entirely, forgotten." That's the best death poem I've ever heard. And he never even wrote it down. Or as Ramana Maharshi said, when his disciples, his followers, asked him if he could please stay alive for just a bit longer, they didn't want him to go. "Please, we don't want you to go," he said. And Ramana just looked at them and he said, "Where is there for me to go? Is there ever more or less of the self? Is there ever more or less of life? Is there ever more or less of existence?" That's a freedom, isn't it? That knowledge is freedom. Oh, your body will drop, of course. But there's no, even when your body drops, life is not diminished. Even the life in your body does not disappear. There's no such thing as energy disappearing. I suppose if we just think we're a particular body, that disappearance is a disaster. But when we know what we really are, there's no coming or going. There's no birth, life, or death. Those are just ways of describing the changing nature of things. But you no more came into existence upon your birth as anything else. Neither will you disappear with death. Oh, the thing that's afraid of disappearing, that'll disappear, I'm afraid to tell you. The thing that's afraid of disappearing, it's toast. And there's no hope for it. None at all, not even the slightest little bit. But the thing in you that's not at all concerned with disappearing, that won't disappear. Because there really isn't any. Okay. That's one of those talks with no beginning, middle, or end. So there will be no summation. No grand conclusion. Isn't that nice when perfection strikes right on the money? I'll be damned. Wow. Thank you for being together.